Chapter 38. Inheritance Crime. Pieces of Martha Sheward were scattered somewhat untidily around the outskirts of the city of Norwich in the east of England. A mongrel dog hunting for a rabbit pulled one of her hands from under a hedge. A farm labourer found another part of her in an overgrown ditch. Medical experts decided that this mystery woman they were starting to jigsaw together must have been aged between 16 and 26, although it was eventually established that she was really 55. A few months later, towards the end of 1851, a constable tapped at the front door of a notorious local drunk, a third-rate impecunious tailor called William Sheward, and asked some disturbing questions. "Where's your wife?" he demanded. "Oh, she's gone away," said Sheward. "I've no idea where she is now." That matched the story that he'd told all the neighbours, and which they'd accepted. The Shewards had rowed violently and publicly over money. Martha was desperately worried that they never had enough. Sheward, a genial optimist, always insisted that one day, somehow, their luck would change. Then they could set up a splendid business and have no more problems. But Martha went on fretting, nagging him and threatening to leave. One evening, befuddled with drink and provoked by her tongue, he silenced her with a pair of tailoring shears. Now he was eyeing the constable warily. "She said she was going to London, but I don't really know. Anyway, why do you want her?"
"Well, there's no need to look so worried. She hasn't done anything wrong. She's inherited some money, that's all. £300. But, of course, she's got to claim it."
Sheward suddenly realised he had murdered his wife a few months too soon. That inheritance would have been enough for them to buy the business they'd always wanted. The bits of the body found around the city were never connected with the disappearance of Martha Sheward because the surgeons had been so wrong in assessing the victim's age. So Sheward was never even suspected of being a killer. And if it hadn't been for that inheritance, he would probably never have been brought to justice. For 18 years he brooded on his loss, tormented by thoughts of how different his life could have been. These thoughts became such an obsession that he convinced himself that he had been the victim of a singularly cruel trick of fate. Finally, he walked into a London police station to unburden himself of the whole sad story. The authorities were unsympathetic, and on April the 20th, 1869, he was hanged in Norwich Castle. The story of the unclaimed legacy had been a major part of the case for the prosecution. A second Mrs. Sheward, married by him during those 18 years of remorse, was left with 2 young sons. She had become a wife and a widow because of the almost forgotten murder of a woman she had never known. But she was far luckier as a second wife than Mrs. Anna Sutherland, the wealthy and hard-drinking owner of 3 of the most fashionable bordellos in Newark. Only a few years after Sheward's execution, Mrs. Sutherland made the most tragic mistake of her life by agreeing to marry a dashing young doctor called Robert W. Buchanan. Dr. Buchanan, who was born in Nova Scotia, amazed his friends in Greenwich Village with the announcement that he had divorced his beautiful young wife. They had always considered the Buchanans to be an idyllically happy couple who adored their small adopted daughter. However, the doctor explained that the happiness had been little more than a veneer and that his flighty wife had run away with another man. So he was left alone to look after the child. But Dr. Buchanan was a surprisingly resilient man, and with almost indecent haste, it seems, he started to console himself with company in the saloons and in the bawdy houses. Soon he was boasting that an older woman called Anna Sutherland, who ran 3 of the best bawdy houses, was showing a flatteringly unprofessional interest in him. Fortunately, she didn't seem to have a jealous or possessive nature, so while treating her as a rather special friend, he continued to avail himself of the services of her girls. He became her personal physician and her principal confidant, and it seemed quite normal for her one evening to invite him and a pair of his drinking companions to witness her last will. The main clause in it did seem a little odd. All her property, worth nearly $60,000, was to go to any husband she might have at the time of her death. 2 days later, although she was more than 15 years older than himself, Buchanan married her in secret. Anna moved into his home in West 11th Street and almost immediately started showing the most unreasonable resentment over him visiting her old houses. She held the view, quite ridiculous in Buchanan's eyes, that he should spend his nights with her. Her attitude so concerned him that he started telling his friends how he longed to get rid of her. It was not long before Anna was taken seriously ill. Buchanan tended her himself, and towards the end called in a series of reputable physicians to help him. These physicians eventually certified that she had died of natural causes, not even suspecting that those causes had been helped by doses of morphine mixed with atropine. Less than 3 weeks after the funeral, Buchanan, wealthier than he'd ever been before, remarried his first wife. But an old friend of Anna's, a man who claimed that he'd helped her build her immoral business and so deserved a hunk of her money, forced an exhumation. In the 1890s, many people in high places, whatever their private morals, were quick publicly to condemn loose living in others. The doctor's patronage of the Bordellos was, in many eyes, enough to brand him as an evil man. And the results of the autopsy confirmed that view. He had little time to enjoy his inheritance before his life came to an end in the electric chair. Doctors' wives, through all the history of crime, seem to have been in a particular danger. Indeed, one of the most fiendish killings for cash enterprises was planned by a medical man, Dr. Edward William Pritchard of Sockyhall Street, Glasgow. In 1865, he murdered two women, his mother-in-law and his wife, so that he could inherit what was then a small fortune of £1,600. He did it with a callous deliberation, and then crowned it with a theatrical gesture which demonstrated his talents as a ham actor. Pritchard was a fine-looking man from a good family. He was unquestionably devoted to his five children, the eldest of whom was only 13 when he murdered their mother. He was also a notorious rake. Women patients suffering from minor complaints were examined far more intimately than most doctors would have considered necessary, and servant girls in his home didn't last long unless they consented to him joining them in their beds. But even if they did share sheets with him, their future employment was by no means guaranteed, for Pritchard considered variety to be the spice of vice. His activities as a sexual enthusiast undermined his interest in his work, and, as a result, his finances suffered. That was why it was so imperative for him to secure the legacy. His reputation was one of the popular subjects of gossip in the Sockyhall Street district. An indication of that came 2 years before he embarked on his inheritance-by-murder scheme, when there was a horrifying incident at the house he was then occupying in nearby Berkeley Street. On May the 5th, 1863, while his wife and one of the two servant girls were conveniently away on a visit, the other servant girl died in a mysterious fire which devastated her attic bedroom. There was a swirl of monstrous allegations and whispers. The girl had been pregnant by Pritchard. Her bedroom door had been bolted from the outside. She had been dumped in there drugged by Pritchard. And then, to stop her blabbing or presenting him with a sixth child, he had started the blaze. The insurance company at first refused to pay him any compensation, but was eventually forced to by threat of legal proceedings. This, then, was the man who had married Mary Jane Taylor, the daughter of a retired Edinburgh silk and lace merchant called Michael Taylor. His mother-in-law had never approved of him, and she arranged for much of her personal money to go direct to her daughter. That meant that Pritchard, in order to get hold of the money, had to kill Mrs. Taylor and then his wife in that order. He was overdrawn at the bank, and creditors were beginning to make ugly noises. The time for action had arrived. At first, he started feeding poison to his wife. Nothing too severe, just enough to make her ill and to keep her in bed. Then he encouraged his mother-in-law to stay with them for a while to help look after her daughter. Mrs. Pritchard began to improve, but the mother-in-law inexplicably became more and more sick. Both invalids were being nursed by a housemaid called Mary MacLeod, who, after Pritchard had thoughtfully aborted a baby she'd been expecting by him, was the most loyal member of the household. Although she was only 15, she cheerfully coped with all the tempers and disconcerting habits of old Mrs. Taylor, and she did have a number of those disconcerting habits, such as bursting unannounced into Pritchard's consulting room when he was giving Mary an enthusiastic kiss. As Mrs. Taylor began to sink further, Pritchard called in another medical man, a Dr. Patterson, for a second opinion. Patterson considered that she was in a state of narcoticism, but for reasons best known to himself took no action and never saw her again. He was later asked to sign the death certificate, but refused and sent a note to the registrar. "I am surprised that I am called to certify the cause of death in this case. I only saw the person for a very short period before her death. She seemed to be under some sort of narcotic, but Dr. Pritchard, who was present from the first moment of the illness until death occurred, and this happened in his own house, may certify the cause. The death was certainly sudden, unexpected, and, to me, mysterious." The registrar, perplexed by this lack of cooperation, asked Pritchard to certify the cause of death. He did so, citing apoplexy following upon paralysis. One down, one to go. Barely 3 weeks later, the final hurdle between him and the legacy was cleared. The cook was startled by the insistent ringing of the bell connected with Mrs. Pritchard's bedroom, and was puzzled that apparently no one else could hear it. She found Pritchard in his consulting room, where he was being ardently consoled by Mary MacLeod, and the three of them hurried to see Mrs. Pritchard. Within hours, she was dead. Pritchard demonstrated his grief by shouting to the body, "Come back! Come back, my dear Mary Jane!" Then he applied a mustard poultice to her in a theatrical attempt to restore her to life, and after the poultice had gone cold, he announced that she had died from gastric fever. Arrangements were made, in deference to the wishes of her family, for her to be buried in her mother's grave in Edinburgh. As the coffin was being carried from his house, Pritchard asked the undertakers to unscrew the lid so that the servants might have one last look at their mistress. Then he rained kisses upon the mouth of the woman whom he had so recently murdered, swearing his passionate and unswerving love. However, an anonymous person wrote to the Procurator Fiscal, drawing attention to very suspicious circumstances surrounding the double bereavement of Dr. Pritchard. Before he had time to make use of his inheritance, Pritchard was arrested. On July the 29th, 1865, nearly 100,000 spectators crushed into Jail Square to see him die. This was to be the last public hanging in Scotland. Exactly 10 years after Pritchard's death, another man, equally hungry for money, was in the process of being married. He, too, was interested exclusively in inheriting money, and his actions during the following 2 years marked him as a particularly sadistic killer. Lewis Staunton, a 24-year-old auctioneer's clerk, found that there was one irresistible attraction about a 36-year-old woman called Harriet Richardson. She was, by any standards, quite exceptionally ugly, dumpy and bovine, with a skin like sun-parched leather. Her mother, who did love her, had tried unsuccessfully to get her certified as a lunatic. But Harriet was rich. In fact, she was worth more than £4,000. Staunton decided that, in order to inherit that sum, he was prepared to tolerate Harriet with all her faults, particularly as he had long-term plans for employing his mistress in the household as the maid. On June the 16th, 1875, they were married, against the wishes of Mrs. Richardson, and they set up home in South London. His mistress soon moved in with them, and once he'd given up his job in the auctioneer's office, the three lived comfortably enough on Harriet's money. But Harriet, an imbecile and filthy in her personal habits, was very much in the way. Staunton therefore arranged for her to take a rest at his brother Patrick's lonely country home near Bromley in Kent. Soon afterwards, he and his mistress, a girl named Alice Rhodes, who was now calling herself Mrs. Staunton, moved into a 20-acre farm near Bromley. Harriet's money was naturally providing the rent of £70 a year, and now that her legacy had been virtually weaned from her, the time for her death was drawing close. Harriet's accommodation in Patrick Staunton's home was a dark and filthy attic. The door was kept permanently locked to prevent her from escaping. The only window was boarded to ensure that people outside could never catch a glimpse of the fast deteriorating prisoner. Her main food was scraps from the downstairs table. They would be served in a bowl, rather like a dog dish, and she would scoop them into her mouth with her hands. Sometimes, for a day or two, there were no leftovers, and that meant there was nothing for Harriet. No one ever spoke to her, and in time she lost the ability to articulate. She was reduced to making strange grunting and snorting noises, and her clothes and her body became revoltingly dirty. She was no longer a woman, no longer a human being. She was a grotesque and shambling animal, no longer in her permanent darkness comprehending whether it was day or night. And downstairs, the people sharing her inheritance waited for her to die. There was, however, a streak of caution in the Staunton brothers. They recognised that it might be dangerous if she died in the house, for that might lead to an investigation into the way she'd been treated. So they decided that she must be moved somewhere else, and in April 1877 they took her to a boarding house in Forbes Road, Penge, in South London, and they explained to the landlady that she was basically healthy, but needed help and persuasion to make her eat. Harriet, they said, was Staunton's mother. Staunton's mistress, Alice, and Patrick Staunton's wife, Elizabeth, shared a room with her while the two men moved into a nearby hotel. On Friday the 13th, Harriet was in a starvation-induced stupor and sinking fast. At 1:30 in the afternoon, she died. If Staunton had then followed the example of Dr. Pritchard and made some display of grief over his bereavement, he would probably never have been brought to justice. But he showed absolutely no emotion. The death certificate was signed by a Dr. Longrigg, and within an hour of Harriet dying, Staunton had paid a local undertaker to bury her on the following Monday. Then, having given instructions to a nurse to lay out the body, he and the other three returned to his home near Bromley. They had no intention of attending the funeral of such a wretched and unimportant creature as Harriet. Their callous attitude, coupled with the nurse's horror at the emaciated and verminous state of Harriet's body, set people talking. And one of the neighbours in Forbes Road chanced to know Harriet's mother, Mrs. Richardson. She could not be certain that this was really Mrs. Richardson's daughter, but she had a feeling. Mrs. Richardson was called, and on police instructions the funeral was stopped. A post-mortem examination showed that Harriet had suffered protracted undernourishment and criminal neglect. Her weight was only 5 stone, about half of what it should have been. The implications were inescapable. On September the 19th, the Staunton brothers and their two women were in court on a charge of murder. The judge, who pronounced the death sentence on the four of them, described their conspiracy as so black and hideous that I believe in all the records of crime it would be difficult to find its parallel. 3 days before the date set for the execution, the Home Secretary intervened. Alice Rhodes was given a free pardon. The Staunton brothers and Mrs. Staunton had their sentences commuted to penal servitude for life, and Mrs. Richardson was left with the realisation that her mentally crippled daughter would still have been alive if only she had never come into that inheritance. All of the men considered so far found that inheritance slithered from their grasp, that crime did not pay. In Britain today, though, there is one man who is very conscious of the fact that crime could prove disastrously expensive for him because of the conditions of a will under which he stood to inherit a fortune in 1992. Peter Asher, born in 1944, was abandoned as a baby on the steps of a home run by a Catholic rescue service in South London. 2 years later, he was adopted by a middle-aged couple, Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Asher, who had no children of their own. Mrs. Asher died when the boy was 4, and a few years later, Mr. Asher, who had made a fortune in a picture postcard business, specialising in the saucy seaside drawings of the artist Donald McGill, also died. A few weeks before his death, Mr. Asher made a will, leaving his shares, which it had been estimated would soon be worth more than £40,000, to Peter Asher. There was, however, one important condition. Asher was not to get the money until he was aged 48, and if by then he had gone to prison for 2 years or more, he would not get it at all. All of it would go to an orphanage. In February 1965, Peter Asher was jailed for 15 months for admitting receiving a stolen chequebook and passing a worthless cheque. It was his 8th conviction. The recorder at Poole in Dorset told him, "I don't believe your offences justify a sentence of 2 years. It would be wrong, therefore, to sentence you to a term of imprisonment which would deprive you of the money." 5 months later, the Court of Criminal Appeal changed the sentence and substituted a 3-year probation order. And then, in April 1967, Asher was again apprehensively standing before the recorder of Poole because of breaches of the probation order. This time he knew there was a real danger of him losing the inheritance. He sighed with relief when the sentence was announced. 9 months in prison. Old Mr. Asher apparently worded his will carefully with the intention of doing the best he possibly could for his adopted son, who, for some reason, he feared would run foul of the law. Many other men have used their wills as a means of sending reproaches from the grave. Stefan Wojciechs, whose will was filed for probate in New York in March 1954, left his wife $2 for good rope to hang herself for all the misery she's caused me during my lifetime. This was double the sum left in 1922 to each of 5 children under the American will of Park Benjamin, father-in-law of the operatic tenor Caruso. Each of them was to get $1 because of their long-continued and persistent undutiful and unfilial conduct towards myself. I have had only ingratitude and no help in supporting the many heavy burdens I've had to bear. The Countess of Stafford in 1719 listened in horrified fury as she heard herself described in her husband's will as the worst of women, who is guilty of all ills, whom I have unfortunately married. He left her 5-and-40 brass halfpence with which to buy a pullet for her supper. Another husband, Sidney Dickinson, did leave his wife a fortune and still couldn't resist a final scathing dig. "The only happy times I ever enjoyed were when my wife sulked. But as she was nearly always sulking, my married life might have been considered happy. Because of this, I am inclined to forget the revulsion the contemplation of her face caused me." There were no censorious comments in the will which provided Thérèse Humbert with her fortune of more than $6 million. Not the slightest suspicion of criticism. That was hardly surprising, for she inherited through the last will and testament of a man who was never even born. And Thérèse's shrewd manipulation of the greedy and the gullible made her the unrivalled queen of inheritors. She was born into a poor country family in Toulouse in France in about 1860, and while still a child she had to work as a washerwoman. She married into a wealthy local family, the Humbert, and her lawyer father-in-law became the country's Minister of Justice. Shortly after her marriage, according to her story, there came a remarkable event which was to change the whole of her life. One afternoon, as she was travelling alone on the Ceinture Railway, she alleged that she heard groans coming from the next compartment. She climbed along the outside footboard to that compartment, and there found an old man in great agony. She unfastened his collar and made him as comfortable as possible. When the train arrived in Paris, he was sufficiently recovered to leave the station without further help. But she claimed before doing so, he told her that he was an American millionaire called Robert Henry Crawford, and he made a note of her name and address. Soon afterwards, she received a copy of the old man's will, showing that he had left her his fortune. However, a second will then turned up, in which the mysterious Mr. Crawford stated that his money was to be divided into three. A third was to go to each of his nephews, Henry and Robert Crawford, and the remaining third was to go to Thérèse's sister, Maria. However, under the terms of this second will, the three legatees were to pay Thérèse some $40,000 a year out of the interest. An extraordinary agreement was then made between the Crawford nephews, who also existed only in Madame Humbert's mind, and Thérèse. All the securities constituting the inheritance should be locked in a safe at Thérèse's home until agreement was reached on how they were to be divided. So, with a man as eminent as Thérèse's father-in-law, the Minister of Justice, confirming that she had inherited a vast fortune, it was hardly surprising that Paris believed the story implicitly. It was never established if the minister was a party to the fraud or if he was merely a dupe, but his role was invaluable. Lawyers and bankers were eager to provide the wealthy Thérèse with heavy loans at high rates of interest, which would be repaid when the safe was opened and the matter settled. She always paid the interest promptly out of the money raised by the loans. For 20 fantastic years, she kept the story going. During all that time, with the safe kept under armed guard, she managed to acquire between $6 and $9 million, all from people who were convinced that they would eventually make a huge profit. To keep the incredible charade on the boil, she instituted a series of court actions against herself. Even the courts who heard them thought they were being brought by the Crawford nephews. These imaginary Crawfords fought, through counsel, time and time again in the courts. They lost cases against Thérèse, and they won them. They appealed, and were appealed against. They wrote countless letters of instructions to leading lawyers, although, in fact, these letters were written by Thérèse's brother. And all the legal bills were footed by Thérèse. The publicity which the court hearings attracted, despite the fact that the Crawfords were never actually seen, convinced the world of the authenticity of the contents of the now famous safe. Then the bubble burst. A series of sceptical articles were printed in the newspaper Le Matin, and almost immediately large numbers of Thérèse's creditors became worried and demanded the return of their money. A judge ordered that the safe be opened. It was found to contain a copper coin and a trouser button. Nothing else. Thérèse and her husband were each sentenced to 5 years solitary confinement. Other members of the family who had taken part in the inheritance conspiracy were also sent to prison, but the father-in-law, who had been so invaluable, was already dead. When she was released from prison in September 1906, Thérèse still insisted that the Crawford millions did exist and were rightfully her property. "I was prepared at the trial to justify my position, when suddenly I saw in court the son of Henry Crawford," she said. "He made a sign to me to keep silent. I decided to suffer even imprisonment rather than speak out." Some years later, when she was living in penury on the outskirts of Paris, she did at last receive a legacy. Her only surviving relative, a brother, left her all his money. So far from being a fortune, it was only a little over $30. An American lawyer, conversant with Thérèse's case and with those involving other inheritance frauds, summed such legatees up when he said cynically, "To expand on the old proverb, where there's a will, there's a way. A way to try to make money illegally."